it out. Fillmore couldn't spit it out like that, all at once. He hemmed and hawed, and finally he blurted out, "Well, when I went to the closet just a minute ago, I noticed something."
"Then you've got it," said Collins triumphantly, and with that he flourished the bottle of Venetienne. "Don't go to a doctor," he added venomously. "They'll bleed you to death, the greedy bastards, and don't stop drinking either. That's all hooey. Take this twice a day, shake it well before using, and nothing's worse than worry. Do you understand? Come on now. I'll give you a syringe and some permanganate when we get back."
And so we started out into the night, down toward the waterfront, where there was the sound of music and shouts and drunken oaths. Collins talking quietly all the while about this and that, about a boy he had fallen in love with, and the devil's time he had to get out of the scrape when the parents got wise to it. From that he switched back to the Baron de Charlus and then to Kurtz, who had gone up the river and got lost, his favorite theme. I liked the way Collins moved against this background of literature continuously. It was like a millionaire who never stepped out of his Rolls Royce. There was no intermediate realm for him between reality and ideas. When we entered the whorehouse on the Quai Voltaire, after he had flung himself on the divan and rung for girls and for drinks, he was still paddling up the river with Kurtz, and only when the girls had flopped on the bed beside him and stuffed his mouth with kisses did he cease his divagations. Then, as if he had suddenly realized where he was, he turned to the old mother who ran the place and gave her an eloquent spiel about his two friends who had come down from Paris expressly to see the joint. There were about half a dozen girls in the room, all naked and all beautiful to look at, I must say. They hopped about like birds while the three of us tried to maintain a conversation with the grandmother. Finally, the latter excused herself and told us to make ourselves at home. I was altogether taken in by her. So sweet and amiable she was, so thoroughly gentle and maternal. And what manners! If she had been a little younger, I would have made overtures to her. Certainly you would not have thought that we were in a den of vice, as it is called. Anyway, we stayed there an hour or so, and as I was the only one in condition to enjoy the privileges of the house, Collins and Fillmore remained downstairs chattering with the girls. When I returned, I found the two of them stretched out on the bed. The girls had formed a semicircle about the bed and were singing with the most angelic voices the chorus of Roses in Picardy. We were sentimentally depressed when we left the house, Fillmore particularly. Collins swiftly steered us to a rough joint which was packed with drunken sailors on shore leave, and there we sat a while enjoying the homosexual rout that was in full swing. When we sallied out, we had to pass through the red light district, where there were more grandmothers with shawls about their necks, sitting on the doorsteps, fanning themselves and nodding pleasantly to the passers-by. All such good-looking, kindly souls, as if they were keeping guard over a nursery. Little groups of sailors came swinging along and pushed their way noisily inside the gaudy joints. Sex everywhere. It was slopping over, a neap tide that swept the props from under the city. We piddled along at the edge of the basin where everything was jumbled and tangled. You had the impression that all these ships, these trawlers and yachts and schooners and barges, had been blown ashore by a violent storm. In the space of 48 hours, so many things had happened that it seemed as if we had been in Le Havre a month or more. We were planning to leave early Monday morning, as Fillmore had to be back on the job. We spent Sunday drinking and carousing, clap or no clap. That afternoon, Collins confided to us that he was thinking of returning to his ranch in Idaho. He hadn't been home for 8 years, and he wanted to have a look at the mountains again before making another voyage east. We were sitting in a whorehouse at the time, waiting for a girl to appear. He had promised to slip her some cocaine. He was fed up with Le Havre, he told us. Too many vultures hanging around his neck. Besides, Jimmy's wife had fallen in love with him, and she was making things hot for him with her jealous fits. There was a scene almost every night. She had been on her good behavior since we arrived, but it wouldn't last, he promised us. She was particularly jealous of a Russian girl who came to the bar now and then when she got tight, a troublemaker. On top of it all, he was desperately in love with this boy whom he had told us about the first day. "A boy can break your heart," he said. "He's so damn beautiful, and so cruel."
We had to laugh at this. It sounded preposterous. But Collins was in earnest. Around midnight Sunday, Fillmore and I retired. We had been given a room upstairs over the bar. It was sultry as the devil, not a breath of air stirring. Through the open windows we could hear them shouting downstairs, and the gramophone going continually. All of a sudden a storm broke, a regular cloudburst, and between the thunderclaps and the squalls that lashed the window panes, there came to our ears the sound of another storm, raging downstairs at the bar. It sounded frightfully close and sinister. The women were shrieking at the top of their lungs, bottles were crashing, tables were upset, and there was that familiar, nauseating thud that the human body makes when it crashes to the floor. About 6 o'clock, Collins stuck his head in the door. His face was all plastered, and one arm was stuck in a sling. He had a big grin on his face.
"Just as I told you," he said. "She broke loose last night. Suppose you heard the racket."
We got dressed quickly and went downstairs to say goodbye to Jimmy. The place was completely demolished. Not a bottle left standing, not a chair that wasn't broken. The mirror and the show window were smashed to bits. Jimmy was making himself an eggnog. On the way to the station, we pieced the story together. The Russian girl had dropped in after we toddled off to bed, and Yvette had insulted her promptly, without even waiting for an excuse. They had commenced to pull each other's hair, and in the midst of it, a big Swede had stepped in and given the Russian girl a sound slap in the jaw to bring her to her senses. That started the fireworks. Collins wanted to know what right this big stiff had to interfere in a private quarrel. He got a poke in the jaw for an answer, a good one, that sent him flying to the other end of the bar.
"Serves you right!"
screamed Yvette, taking advantage of the occasion to swing a bottle at the Russian girl's head. And at that moment, the thunderstorm broke loose. For a while there was a regular pandemonium, the women all hysterical and hungry to seize the opportunity to pay off private grudges. Nothing like a nice barroom brawl. So easy to stick a knife in a man's back or club him with a bottle when he's lying under a table. The poor Swede found himself in a hornet's nest. Everyone in the place hated him, particularly his shipmates. They wanted to see him done in. And so they locked the door, and pushing the tables aside, they made a little space in front of the bar where the two of them could have it out. And they had it out. They had to carry the poor devil to the hospital when it was over. Collins had come off rather lucky, nothing more than a sprained wrist and a couple of fingers out of joint, a bloody nose, and a black eye. Just a few scratches, as he put it. But if he ever signed up with that Swede, he was going to murder him. It wasn't finished yet. He promised us that. And that wasn't the end of the fracas, either. After that, Yvette had to go out and get liquored up at another bar. She had been insulted, and she was going to put an end to things. And so she hires a taxi and orders the driver to ride out to the edge of the cliff, overlooking the water. She was going to kill herself. That's what she was going to do. But then she was so drunk that when she tumbled out of the cab, she began to weep, and before anyone could stop her, she had begun to peel her clothes off. The driver brought her home that way, half naked, and when Jimmy saw the condition she was in, he was so furious with her that he took his razor strop and he belted the piss out of her, and she liked it, the bitch that she was. "Do it some more," she begged, down on her knees as she was and clutching him around the legs with her two arms, but Jimmy had enough of it. "You're a dirty old sow," he said, and with his foot he gave her a shove in the guts that took the wind out of her, and a bit of her sexy nonsense, too. It was high time we were leaving. The city looked different in the early morning light. The last thing we talked about as we stood there waiting for the train to pull out was Idaho. The three of us were Americans. We came from different places, each of us, but we had something in common. A whole lot, I might say. We were getting sentimental, as Americans do when it comes time to part. We were getting quite foolish about the cows and sheep and the big open spaces where men are men and all that crap. If a boat had swung along instead of the train, we'd have hopped aboard and said goodbye to it all. But Collins was never to see America again, as I learned later. And Fillmore, well, Fillmore had to take his punishment too, in a way that none of us could have suspected then. It's best to keep America just like that, always in the background, a sort of picture postcard which you look at in a weak moment. Like that, you imagine it's always there waiting for you, unchanged,
unspoiled, a big, patriotic, open space with cows and sheep and tender-hearted men ready to bugger everything in sight, man, woman, or beast. It doesn't exist, America. It's a name you give to an abstract idea. Paris is like a whore. From a distance, she seems ravishing. You can't wait until you have her in your arms. And 5 minutes later, you feel empty, disgusted with yourself. You feel tricked. I returned to Paris with money in my pocket, a few hundred francs which Collins had shoved in my pocket just as I was boarding the train. It was enough to pay for a room and at least a week's good rations. It was more than I had had in my hands at one time for several years. I felt elated, as though perhaps a new life was opening before me. I wanted to conserve it, too, so I looked up a cheap hotel over a bakery on the Rue du Château, just off the Rue de Vanves, a place that Eugene had pointed out to me once. A few yards away was the bridge that spans the Montparnasse tracks, a familiar quarter. I could have had a room for 100 francs a month, a room without any conveniences, to be sure, without even a window, and perhaps I would have taken it, just to be sure of a place to flop for a while, had it not been for the fact that in order to reach this room, I would have been obliged to first pass through the room of a blind man. The thought of passing his bed every night had a most depressing effect upon me. I decided to look elsewhere. I went over to the Rue Celle, just behind the cemetery, and I looked at a sort of rat-trap there with balconies running around the courtyard. There were bird cages suspended from the balcony, too, all along the lower tier. A cheerful sight, perhaps, but to me it seemed like the public ward in a hospital. The proprietor didn't seem to have all his wits, either. I decided to wait for the night, to have a good look around, and then choose some attractive little joint in a quiet side street. At dinner time, I spent 15 francs for a meal, just about twice the amount I had planned to allot myself. That made me so wretched that I wouldn't allow myself to sit down for a coffee, even despite the fact that it had begun to drizzle. No, I would walk about a bit, and then go quietly to bed at a reasonable hour. I was already miserable, trying to husband my resources this way. I had never in my life done it. It wasn't in my nature. Finally, it began to come down in buckets full. I was glad. That would give me the excuse I needed to duck somewhere and stretch my legs out. It was still too early to go to bed. I began to quicken my pace, heading back toward the Boulevard Raspail. Suddenly, a woman comes up to me and stops me, right in the pouring rain. She wants to know what time it is. I told her I didn't have a watch, and then she bursts out just like this. "Oh, my good sir, do you speak English by chance?" I nod my head. It's coming down in torrents now. "Perhaps, my dear good man, you would be so kind as to take me to a café. It is raining so, and I haven't the money to sit down anywhere. You will excuse me, my dear sir, but you have such a kind face. I knew you were English right away." And with this, she smiles at me, a strange, half-demented smile. "Perhaps you could give me a little advice, dear sir. I am all alone in the world. My God, it is terrible to have no money." This dear sir, and kind sir, and my good man, etc., had me on the verge of hysteria. I felt sorry for her, and yet I had to laugh. I did laugh. I laughed right in her face. And then she laughed too, a weird, high-pitched laugh, off-key, an altogether unexpected piece of cachinnation. I caught her by the arm, and we made a bolt for it to the nearest café. She was still giggling when we entered the bistro. "My dear good sir," she began again, "perhaps you think I am not telling you the truth. I am a good girl. I come of a good family. Only," and here she gave me that wan, broken smile again, "only I'm so misfortunate as not to have a place to sit down." At this I began to laugh again. I couldn't help it. The phrases she used, the strange accent, the crazy hat she had on, that demented smile. "Listen," I interrupted, "what nationality are you?"
"I'm English," she replied. "That is, I was born in Poland, but my father is Irish."
"So that makes you English?"
"Yes," she said,
and she began to giggle again, sheepishly, and with a pretense of being coy. "I suppose you know a nice little hotel where you could take me?" I said this not because I had any intention of going with her,
but just to spare her the usual preliminaries.
"Oh, my dear sir," she said, as though I had made the most grievous error, "I'm sure you don't mean that. I'm not that kind of a girl."
"You were joking with me, I can see that. You're so good. You have such a kind face. I would not dare to speak to a Frenchman as I did to you. They insult you right away." She went on in this vein for some time. I wanted to break away from her, but she didn't want to be left alone. She was afraid. Her papers were not in order. Wouldn't I be good enough to walk her to her hotel? Perhaps I could lend her 15 or 20 francs to quiet the patron. I walked her to the hotel where she said she was stopping, and I put a 50-franc bill in her hand. Either she was very clever or very innocent, it's hard to tell sometimes, but at any rate she wanted me to wait until she ran to the bistro for change. I told her not to bother, and with that she seized my hand impulsively and raised it to her lips. I was flabbergasted. I felt like giving her every damned thing I had. That touched me, that crazy little gesture. I thought to myself, it's good to be rich once in a while, just to get a new thrill like that. Just the same, I didn't lose my head. 50 francs, that was quite enough to squander on a rainy night. As I walked off, she waved to me with that crazy little bonnet, which she didn't know how to wear. It was as though we were old playmates. I felt foolish and giddy. "My dear kind sir, you have such a gentle face, you are so good, etc." I felt like a saint. When you feel all puffed up inside, it isn't so easy to go to bed right away. You feel as though you ought to atone for such unexpected bursts of goodness. Passing the jungle, I caught a glimpse of the dance floor. Women with bare backs and ropes of pearls choking them, or so it looked, were wiggling their beautiful bottoms at me. Walked right up to the bar and ordered a coupe of champagne. When the music stopped, a beautiful blonde, she looked like a Norwegian, took a seat right beside me. The place wasn't as crowded or as gay as it had appeared from outside. There were only a half dozen couples in the place. They must have all been dancing at once. I ordered another coupe of champagne in order not to let my courage dribble away. When I got up to dance with the blonde, there was no one on the floor but us. Any other time I would have been self-conscious, but the champagne and the way she clung to me, the dimmed lights and the solid feeling of security which the few hundred francs gave me, well, we had another dance together, a sort of private exhibition, and then we fell into conversation. She had begun to weep. That was how it started. I thought possibly she had had too much to drink, so I pretended not to be concerned. And meanwhile, I was looking around to see if there was any other timber available. But the place was thoroughly deserted. The thing to do when you're trapped is to breeze at once. If you don't, you're lost. What retained me, oddly enough, was the thought of paying for a hat check a second time. One always lets himself in for it because of a trifle. The reason she was weeping, I discovered soon enough, was because she had just buried her child. She wasn't Norwegian either, but French, and a midwife to boot. A chic midwife, I must say, even with the tears running down her face. I asked her if a little drink would help to console her, whereupon she very promptly ordered a whiskey and tossed it off in the wink of an eye. "Would you like another?" I suggested gently. She thought she would. She felt so rotten, so terribly dejected. She thought she would like a package of Camels, too. "No, wait a minute," she said. "I think I'd rather have Le Pall Mall." "Have what you like," I thought, "but stop weeping, for Christ's sake. It gives me the willies." I jerked her to her feet for another dance. On her feet, she seemed to be another person. Maybe grief makes one more lecherous. I don't know. I murmured something about breaking away. "Where to?" she said eagerly. "Oh, anywhere. Some quiet place where we can talk." I went to the toilet and counted the money over again. I hid the 100-franc notes in my fob pocket and kept a 50-franc note and the loose change in my trousers pocket. I went back to the bar, determined to talk turkey. She made it easier for me because she herself introduced the subject. She was in difficulties. It was not only that she had just lost her child, but her mother was home, ill, very ill, and there was the doctor to pay and medicine to be bought and so on and so forth. I didn't believe a word of it, of course. And since I had to find a hotel for myself, I suggested that she come along with me and stay the night. A little economy there, I thought to myself. But she wouldn't do that. She insisted on going home, said she had an apartment to herself, and besides, she had to look after her mother.
On reflection, I decided that it would be still cheaper sleeping at her place, so I said yes.